Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. The legislature is still in session. They're down to, what, the last 4 days, I think. They're supposed to finish up next Tuesday, so we're going to have a lot to talk about on the show today about the action down at the state capitol. But we'll also be talking about a lot more than that, as we always try to do on this show. Kevin Riley, it's Tuesdays, the day that we look forward to welcoming you on the panel. Kevin is, of course, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the boss of the other AJC reporters who come on this show. Hi, Kevin.
Thanks, Bill. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. By the way, I want to say something while we're talking about you as the editor of the AJC. If people, I don't know how many, have we retweeted the To Politics GPB, the tweet that I put out with David Brooks' column from the New York Times, Robert or Tom? Yeah. If you follow us at all on Twitter, go to Politics GPB. David Brooks in the New York Times wrote what I thought was a really important column today. He certainly synthesized some of my feelings, Kevin, about how the media may want to rethink what went on during the 22 months of the Robert Mueller investigation. And I go to the Twitter page and read the column. But the most important thing he said was, I think, was that, you know, real reporters for the New York Times, Washington Post, other national publications did real reporting throughout all of this for the most part. But the cable news networks, instead of reporting news, spent 22 months on rampant speculation.
Right.
Robert Mueller sneezed on his way into his office today. Let's spend the next 40 minutes talking about what we think that means about where this investigation is headed. And I felt that way throughout this entire period of time. And I think that Brooks is right, that those organizations and any others who were doing speculation instead of actual reporting ought to be thinking about how they handled all this in the same way that the Sean Hannitys of the world ought to be thinking about how they treated Robert Mueller, accused him of a witch hunt, said he was, you know, conflicted, an angry Democrat, all that sort of thing.
Right. Well, Bill, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned it. I have to tell you, that's part of the reason I'm here and why I try to be here every Tuesday, is because I think here on this show, as we'll do today and as you do with the show, and certainly in the newspaper, we really work hard at that. We're not trying to fill hours and hours of programming where the idea is to put on the most provocative people saying the most outrageous things so that people will continue to watch and tune in tomorrow. I mean, one of the reasons I like to be on the show is because, I mean, like today, we have two incredibly smart people. They may have different opinions, but they don't scream and yell at each other and reason.
Yeah. You know, Theron and Jackie, you just haven't seen them.
You haven't seen us together.
She's kidding. Remember, Kevin, you witnessed her started with me before the show. She took the first poke at me before the show started.
But my point is that
I love you too.
I feel like the mission of the newspaper, certainly the mission of this show, yeah, is to make sure that Georgians who want to be informed and understand what's going on, yeah, get the real story, make their decisions, yeah, have a chance to do
it. Well, yeah, thank you. I agree. I'm very proud of the fact that we were never once in the Trump speculation game, and I'm proud of that. I'm proud of all of us on the show because
I may have jinxed
us,
though. We'll probably have a brawl breakout here in the studio today.
So we have informally introduced our panelists today. Jackie Cushman is a conservative columnist. I read your latest column. I think you just posted it a couple days ago in Town Hall. It's called Sheep for Dinner, and it's about something that Democrat Steve Cohn from Nashville has really been talking a lot about, which is...
Absolutely. We're looking at, look at the Electoral College. So there's a lot of talk now about should we do away with it, because if you look at the map, clearly the way it's constructed, it gives a lot of weight to states that don't have a lot of people, but that was the way it was constructed on purpose so that those states would have a voice in it. And the idea is if you have the sheep for dinner, if you have three people and you have you know, two wolves and a sheep. I mean, who's going to be for dinner, right? You can figure that one out pretty easily.
Do you write your own headlines?
Yeah, I think I need to do a better job. Can you help me with that? What are you talking about?
Sheep for dinner was good. Anyhow.
But I do think it's an important topic. We need to think about things before we just jump in and, you know, and have an opinion about them. How is it actually constructed? What does it actually, you know, do? And what was the purpose of it?
Well,
it's important.
You can read Jackie's column. You can get to it easily two ways. JackieCushman.com, which is her homepage, which is a page that talks about her and her books. It'll also link you to the column. You can go to Town Hall and just find you at Town Hall, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Theron Johnson is with us, just back. You said you were in Washington?
Yeah, I went to an APAC conference, and so it was really good. I only spent a little bit of time up there, but it was good to be with some of my colleagues from the Southeast region to learn more about all the good work the APAC is doing.
Theron Johnson, most of you already know, Democratic political consultant. He played a big role in the Barack Obama reelection campaign. You oversaw the Southeastern region of the campaign, isn't that right?
I did.
A lot of work with Kasim Reed.
Yeah. And Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms.
And I was going to ask you, are you working pretty hard?
Well, I'm not officially on a payroll, so I know the AJC is probably
looking
into
that. We'll check on that.
Yeah, sit a little note for yourself.
But big supporter of hers as well. So,
All right. Here. Well, it's great to have you you all here today. Let's start with something that happened yesterday. The SB 106, even as we went on the air yesterday, it was just being introduced in the House for a vote. This is really, Kevin, Governor Kemp's signature legislation this session. He calls it the Patient's First Act. What it essentially does is it gives back to the governor the power to apply for Medicaid waivers for some people in the poorest income brackets in the state. And it also allows him to do what he says he wants to do, which is to come up with subsidies for people who are buying insurance on the exchange, but really could use financial help in doing that. It's, for him, a big deal. It remains a very controversial measure.
Right. Well, I know that it's got a fancy name and there's been a lot of talk about it, but this is Medicaid expansion in the end. I mean, I think we could say that, right? I mean,
I'm not sure Democrats might say it's sort of Medicaid expansion.
It's a limited Medicaid expansion. I think you'd agree with that, Theron. It's a portion, right?
And into your question, Kevin, and add on Jackie's point, you know, Democrats who were very vocal in opposition of this is saying that it's just a first step towards Medicaid expansion. But this bill, as you just talked about, Bill, is it gives the governor this legislative authority to begin the process of this waiver program. But what Democrats were saying is, why don't we just go ahead and do what's worked in about a dozen other states? And that is just do what Stacey Abrams called for during her campaign, which is to fully expand Medicaid. But I would say this as a Democrat. I want to commend the governor publicly for doing something that has not been done as of yet. I mean, he is working hard. It was a campaign promise that he made to enter into this waiver program. But I would also say that I also back up, you know, Minority Leader Bob Trammell, who encouraged the governor when he spoke out against this measure, saying, let's make sure that this is not the end all be all. And I think that you're going to see more and more conversations about how you get to full Medicaid expansion.
The governor, Jackie, his proposal would provide Medicaid for Georgians earning at 100% of the poverty level. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how many people that is, essentially, we think. Whereas Democrats, like a Bob Trammell, say that we could go further. We ought to take that number. The federal government is glad to let us go up to 138% of the poverty level, and we're missing a large chunk of Georgians as a result.
Well, I mean, I think that's the answer is yes, but this is a way. This is Governor Kemp, who did promise the first part of this act, which is the waivers to help those that have pre-existing conditions that have higher payments to offset that. Okay, that's part one. Part two is this now reaching into 100% or below and helping them as well, and opening up that for, you know, healthcare for them. And I think the answer would be let's make this and let's see where we are and see how it works. And then to Theron's point, I think then you have another discussion. I think in any negotiation like this, you're going to have one side that thinks if you have both sides that think they're not really quite happy, then you'll probably have a good negotiation, because if one side got everything, it wouldn't be a negotiation. It would be that's what we're doing. So to me, this sounds like it ends up in the right place. And the other thing that you mentioned that I want to make sure the listeners understand is the interesting part to me is this is giving back to the governor the authority he had that was stripped right. in 2014 because there was concern. And I'll say why, because there was concern that deal could have been beaten. And so they wanted to make sure that the authority wasn't there if that happened. And then I just think that's an interesting political point, right? I think that's interesting to know. Yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. What's so confusing about this? Wait a minute. I thought the Democrats wanted the governor to have
In 2014, Kevin, there was fear in the General Assembly that it was possible that Jason Carter could beat Nathan Deal. And the last thing they wanted was the Democratic governor to have what had always been the prerogative of the governor, the right to determine Medicaid expansion.
Well, and Jackie used the word stripped. I think that's a little strong. I mean, they passed the bill and the governor signed it and agreed to let that happen.
Right? No, but feel free to edit my words. But the point is the governor has had this power forever until 2014 when it was taken away.
And what's so good about Jackie, guys, is that she's willing to come on this radio show and tell the truth. And so, what the Democrats were saying is now this new bill gives the governor broad new authority without requiring any final legislative sign-off. And so that was one of the criticisms that we heard about this. But the other thing I want to say really quickly, Bill, is that this bill, and I think Jackie may agree with me on this, is that it is a first step, but it does not solve our problem with poor and rural people.
Explain that.
Because I think that, again, many people believe AJC has done many, many polls will show that the majority of Georgians think that we should fully expand Medicaid.
Like 70%, I think.
70%.
Yeah.
And so the only criticism that I've really heard is that it does not go far enough to help. But also, another argument that Democrats made, I think, in a very good way, is that this is a way for us to spur our economy in Georgia. I mean, if you expand Medicaid, it can definitely help the economy continue to build. And so I think that you saw an economic message from Democrats here as well. But the bottom line is this. The governor needed a win. He needed this to happen very soon. It shows strength. But I tell you, I think that you look at Leader Trammell and Leader Henson and the state senate, Steve Henson, Democrats are going to continue to be very vocal about the opposition of this bill.
But don't you think they might be, I mean, at this stage, asking for a little too much? I mean, think about the movement from where the state was, where the former governor and legislature were saying, absolutely no way, we won't even think about it. So now they've moved the ball forward in a way that's clear and discernible. Although whatever's going on in Washington with the Trump administration complicates it, I'm sure. But I mean, could they have expected to get as far as they're talking about getting it all at once?
I think, you know, even Kevin, for me to come on and publicly say, hey, I commend the governor with pushing this forward, I think that you see a different tone and tenor from Democrats. I think what you saw from Leader Trammell in particular, you know, when we first started this debate about Medicaid waivers, he also tried to attach it to community certificates of need. So we know how that argument kind of went away. And so I don't think we're going too far. I do think that Democrats know that your polling show that people in this state, 70% of them actually agree that we should fully expand Medicaid. The challenge now is that you got a governor who got a big win, who got something passed. So now you got to kind of reframe your argument and make it as if you're trying to work with the governor to get this further, not necessarily oppose this first step.
No, I mean, I totally agree. I think that's part of the process is, again, the first part of the bill was what he agreed to during his campaign. The second part, I think, to your point there, and he actually moved towards the Democrats, not as far as they wanted. But again, that's part of the process that we have. And I think if both sides, you know, I think it moves some Republicans farther than they wanted to be, quite frankly. And it's not quite as far as the Democrats want, which means it's probably a good place to start.
So, Jackie, one of the arguments the Democrats made as this went on during the session was that they got an estimate of the costs to the state for expanding Medicaid across the board. And they said it would cost about $200 million. Theron's nodding at that. But so let me throw this out, because that came up again as they were debating this measure. The $200 million that Bob Trammell is talking about is the state share of Medicaid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The problem with that is it doesn't address what the Republican leadership from Nathan Deal to David Perdue and now to Brian Kemp have been saying they're concerned about, which is not just the state share, But the concern that this 9-to-1 match, which the federal government offers because of Obamacare, could go away, suddenly you've expanded Medicaid to the entire state, and you're stuck figuring out how to pay for what the feds used to. Now, there's no reason to think it is going away, but that's the argument Republicans have always used.
Well, and I think that's the classic Republican. I mean, you know, we're very skeptical in general, no matter who is in office in Washington, that, you know, the winds blow in different ways in Washington, depending on how things, you know, change over time. And in the end, if it's in our state, we're going to have to make sure it gets paid, whether it's by us or by the federal government. And yes, there's a match now, but if something changes, it may go away. And quite frankly, that just makes Republicans very nervous. And again, I think that's why this is a good first step. It's, you know, it's 100% of poverty and below, so it's the people that need it the most, which is where you want to start. And then I think you look at it again, you look where the wins are, and then you decide what's next.
Two quick points. But one of the things that we also heard at the Capitol, and I'm hearing it as I were on my way here today, is that this plan in its current form, which may change, as Jackie just pointed out, and you made a good point about the federal match, it basically costs more and covers less people. And I think that's you want to know a Democratic tagline, Kevin, if mm-hmm. I was running a campaign, you know, for state house and state senate, is that we in its current form has a plan that basically costs more and covers less people. The second thing is one of the things that we kind of alluded to is all about ensuring this gap that we talked about. We heard a lot during the gubernatorial race between now Governor Kemp and then the gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams about this closing this gap where you have people who, depending on their income, you just alluded to it, Jackie, are just kind of stuck in this gap and they have no access to affordable health care. And so, again, this waiver program, while it's a step forward, we still got to be able to make sure that you're ensuring that coverage gap is being filled.
Well, the governor does think this is his signature legislation. And one sign of that is one of your political reporters, Greg Bluestein, let me know a little while ago that the signing ceremony is already planned. It'll be held tomorrow at 2 o'clock. So the governor is, I think you said, Theron, he's not going to waste too much time signing this.
Well, maybe you should remind Greg who he works for, because he didn't send me a note about
that. Ooh, that's somebody warning Bluestein right now.
My first question to him was, thanks for telling me you're not going to miss the show tomorrow because of that. And he's got that covered. Let's talk about an ancillary subject that really fits in right here. Kevin, and I'm open to arguments from Jackie, if you'd like to make it, Jackie. But after the victory that there's no question the president got the other day as a result of the Mueller investigation, it appears to some extent that the administration maybe trying to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory. The Justice Department this morning filed a federal lawsuit to entirely overturn the Affordable Care Act. I think many people were stunned that after a 2018 election campaign in which health care and particularly pre-existing conditions was such a huge issue, and 2 days after the Mueller report, Republicans would go out there and take up this issue.
Right. So what happened, right, we had that ruling in, I guess it was Texas, right, in federal court where a judge mm-hmm. just said,
yeah, it's Texas.
The whole law is invalid, unconstitutional. So now it's at the United States Courts of Appeal, United States Court of Appeals in the Fifth District. And the administration apparently it just sent a couple sentences to the court and said, we're not going to fight it. We agree with the ruling. So that's a huge, huge thing if the appeals court just lets the ruling stand, right?
Jackie?
No, I think it is a huge thing. And so I think what to your point about, you're exactly right about the midterm elections and healthcare was a big part of that. And I think the Democrats did a very good job focusing their message pretty much nationwide on the federal elections, which is quite commendable. So I do think if this does go forward, the Republicans, I would hope that they have a real strong replacement plan, right? We can't repeal and not replace, or repeal and hope for the best, or repeal and don't know what we're doing. But it does become more challenging because you have the Senate, you know, you have the Senate's controlled by Republicans, and you've got Nancy Pelosi in the House. And, you know, of all things Nancy Pelosi is, she's very smart and a very good operator.
I think, Theron, this does seem to me to hand a gift to the Democrats in Congress. Look, they're on the rope. They're trying to figure out, after the Mueller report exonerated the president from from collusion. It's a little less clear what it did in terms of
obstruction.
Right. But they're trying. They're sort of rudderless for the time. How do we move forward? Now, Pelosi, as Jackie says, has always said, no, we've got business. If we stick to our agenda, to the things we believe in, we'll be fine. But this gives them a gift.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the national conversation right now, all the presidential candidates have shifted from, at first they were saying, hey, we want to make it public. You want to make this Mueller report public, because I think they were kind of hedging. They didn't know what was going to be in it. But then you saw a shift, Bill, to now talking about making sure that this tax cut plan, which we've seen is not really working for middle class Americans. But now, 3 days ago, we celebrated the ninth year anniversary of Affordable Care Act. 3 days ago. So on March 23rd is when the Affordable Care Act was passed and became law. And so now this gives an opportunity for Democrats to go back into their districts, to go all around the country and say, hey, listen, here Republicans go again with this, you know, repeal option, but they don't have anything to replace it with. And so it was really a gift, but it's the one issue that I think that we've seen grow in popularity, because we know that there's a huge amount of people out there right now who have pre-existing conditions that have benefited from the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I mean, it's a gift in another way, too, Kevin. I think everybody, Republican and Democrat, does imagine there's going to be some uptick, but most people think small, in the president's approval ratings as a result of this. But the reason this seems to me to be a gift is that we know from polling far fewer Americans care one way or the other about the Mueller investigation and Russian collusion than they do about their health care.
Right. Well, and if you look at what the Democrats did today, they went right to the pre-existing condition benefit, which has been enormously popular all along. Even when Obamacare had very low popularity, the pre-existing condition part of it had high popularity, and that's where they are.
And you're right. And that's going to be interesting to see what happens. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. Is that President Trump has been very clear that he wanted to make sure that there was something for pre-existing conditions and that remained. So again, I think we have to wait and see what both sides do, and hopefully it will be better than what we did for the midterms, which was, you know, the Democrats had a very solid message about health care, and quite frankly, Republicans, and we can discuss later about the tax cut did have a great effect on the economy, and so we can, they're not going to do this offline, help middle class too. But anyway, I think the problem was Republicans were consistent about what they'd already done, where the Democrats were focusing on what they were going to do, and I think that focus is a very different focus that people understand.
I have to ask though, because I mean, we have two. All right. Brilliant strategist.
We have to get
room.
To a break, so ask it, and then we'll take a break and come back and answer it.
When we get back, the answer I want is, why would the administration do this today? I want, from each of you, the best possible reason.
I think that's a great one, and on the way into the break, I just want to reinforce something you said. At the lunch, you know, we know that the president was on the Hill today to have a celebratory lunch with Republicans. On the way in, he told reporters that this is the year of health care for Republicans. So we'll watch how that comes together. So we'll get to Kevin Riley's question, but first this break.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR. Or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Since President Trump was elected, the city of Portland, Oregon has seen violent protests between the far left and far right.
How am I supposed to explain this to my 12-year-old daughter, that we allow adults to fight on the streets of our city?
I'm Audie Cornish. What happens when civil protest boils over into civil unrest? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4 till 7 here on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
Jackie Cushman, before the break, Kevin Riley wanted to hear from you and Theron Johnson. Why would the administration decide to try to completely wipe out Obamacare at this moment in time?
Well, Bill, I think you had it before we left, and I pulled it up, and sure enough, I'm behind because I haven't been following President Trump's tweets by the minute, which you have to do. and sure enough, he tweeted an hour ago, the Republican Party will become the party of health care. So my guess, so obviously he's noticed in the midterms, the Democrats did a very good job running on that message that we needed a solution for health care, and I guess he's got from now until next election to lay it out and...
So you're saying not the wall this election, only health care.
He's going to have the wall by then.
That's...
Okay. So that's where I was actually going to go there. I think that it was a sort of postponement of the conversation, not only about the wall, but this infrastructure plan. And this infrastructure, you know, all this money is supposed to be going to these rural counties and to these rural areas of America. And so I think it was a punt. But I think to Jackie's point, I got to agree with her. Exit polling showed, Kevin and Bill, that health care was the way that even Lucy McBath, who talked about gun control and gun violence in this country, but she also had a message around healthcare, mm-hmm. picked up a lot of suburban women, not only in Georgia, but all across the country. And so what you're seeing now from the administration is a sort of pivot away from the wall, away from infrastructure. He sort of feels vindicated at a time where we still had 30 people, I think, that go to jail over this Russia Mueller investigation, right? So while he hasn't been necessarily implicated as far as collusion, the obstruction conversation is still ongoing. And so what he's trying to do now, Kevin, is take a issue that I think Democrats are going to continue to be strong on, but to try to move towards the middle and show the American people, hey, the Republicans have got a health care plan too. But it always comes down to one thing, how are you going to pay for it? And so I think that's where you're going to see the difference in the philosophies and the proposal from Democrats and Republicans.
All right. Well, it'll be interesting to watch how that unfolds in the months ahead. Another piece of breaking news that happened shortly before we went on the air, and just to set it up briefly, both the Senate and the House have now passed their separate versions of the so-called fetal heartbeat bill. They've both approved the measure, which would all but outlaw abortion in Georgia, demanding that after 6 weeks, after essentially what is supposed to be a heartbeat, but we've learned isn't really a heartbeat at all, but about 6 weeks in, after that, no abortion. But the Senate version was slightly different than the House version. And so right now, the Senate bill is back in the House, and they now have to vote to approve or disapprove of the changes. Theron, we don't see any reason, we didn't see any reason why the House, although there are likely to be some suburban Republicans who find themselves mm-hmm. unavailable to cast a vote.
Take
this
a walk.
This thing is headed toward the governor's desk eventually, isn't it?
And unfortunately, it is.
Okay.
You know, I echo many of the men, but more importantly, women who are pro-choice that came down to the Capitol, about hundreds, if not thousands, and by the way, peacefully protested this bill. I mean, you did have some little organized chaos. And so, but one of the things that I'm learning is, Bill, as a person who is not a parent yet, hoping to be a parent very soon, I've opened my ears to hear both sides of the story. And even if you talk to someone who's really pro-life, they still do not necessarily want to take away the ability for a woman to decide what she should do with her body or not. And I think even if you talk to some of the dads and the men, this is a very emotional decision that some of them have had to make. And so I'm trying mm-hmm. to take the partisanship out of this a little bit and really bring a level of humanization to it. And again, I'm pro-choice. I think that men especially should not tell women what they should or should not do with their bodies. But I think that as we go on and look at this bill to manifest, you're going to see this be a big, big conversation in the upcoming primary elections on both sides.
The breaking news, Jackie, which we got from Kevin's Senate reporter, Maya Prabhu, is that Georgia Right to Life, one of the most important mm-hmm. pro-life, anti-abortion groups in the state, is now urging members in the House to reject this bill because it doesn't go far enough. It has provisions that account for the life of the mother, rape and incest, that
sort of
thing.
And again, it's also through 6 weeks, which does provide some time. So this is, I agree with Theron that this is a very, obviously a very emotionally charged issue. I have two children. I've actually had two miscarriages before I had my children. So I've been through both the trauma of losing to me what was a child, even though it was very early, twice. And then I was lucky enough to be able to have two children. So it is a hard topic. I'd like to back up and say, I don't think, and of course I can't change what happened, but I don't think the bill would have come up like it did if he wouldn't have seen what happened in Virginia and New York, quite frankly, if he wouldn't have seen the extreme Democratic position of if in the third trimester, you know, something happens, then you can basically, and I'm going to, you correct me, I know you can basically kill the child. I mean, I know it's more complicated than that, but it was a very extreme position from the left. And I think without that, you would have actually seen what Governor Kemp originally suggested, which was, I believe, we would just pass a law so that if Roe v. Wade was overturned, that it would actually become law in Georgia.
The Trier bill.
Right. So that would have been a different, I think that was the initial where we would have ended up if it wouldn't have been for kind of this craziness, the Democratic craziness in, you know, in Virginia and New York.
Do you think then that all the southern, these states, mostly in the South, that have passed similar bills, Kentucky, Mississippi, I think Ohio is still debating one, not in the South, and a few others, they're all passing fetal heartbeat bills.
Absolutely.
Because, that sounds less like a reaction to Virginia and New York and more like the conservative.
I disagree with you. I disagree. Okay. That's my opinion. Again, okay. I could be wrong because I can't turn back time and I can't say what, you know, would have happened. But that's kind of my working theory. But having said that, I do understand why Right to Life, if you really believe that life begins at conception, if that's, I'm not saying it's your belief, but if that's one's belief, then you can see why both it wouldn't be enough for Right to Life, but also where the 6 weeks really, it does make sense for most people because it still allows some leniency in terms of ability to make decisions. But so it's a really hard topic.
It's an incredibly hard topic, and you're so right about that. And Kevin, you know, one of the arguments we heard from opponents of this bill, 481, from the well of the Senate, too, as well as the House, is this, that if you really are on the side of supporting 481, you do that because you believe that you're taking a life when you mm-hmm. abort a child. The minute you make an exception for things like rape, incest, life of the mother, viability of the fetus, whatever, you're belying your belief that this is essentially murder. So exceptions seem to be what Georgia Right to Life is saying. You can't kill a child just because of the way in which it was conceived.
Right. I would say that I agree with Jackie. I mean, Georgia Right to Life's position is consistent. Mm-hmm. Whether you agree with it or not, they are being consistent in what they have said and what I assume they will continue to say. You just have to question the reality of politics and the legislative process. I mean, if this issue is so important to you, it's hard to imagine that you would ever get further than this with a law in the United States.
The other thing, if it's still in there, and it's not, just correct me, because it could have changed since I read it last week. But I think it also, doesn't it also say that once you hit 6 weeks, you're also counted as a citizen in Georgia?
Yes, you're counted. You will be counted in the state Senate, which means
census.
You can be elected to the Senate, too. But yes, it does say that. It has a lot of other personhood provisions. Theron, is there any part of you that wonders if Georgia Right to Life's position on this could give some of those Republicans who really don't want to vote for this because they're worried about what it might mean for reelection an opportunity to bail? Or are those people going to bail anyway and not going to make a difference in the House's approve, disapprove?
Well, one of the things, Bill, you guys have talked about on this show a long time is that I think it's this mad dash for Republicans in the House and the Senate to get as many conservative measures they can pass this 2-year session, because it is anticipated that Democrats are going to pick up House seats and going to pick up Senate seats. And so, you know, for our listeners, let's just bring the politics into this, is that you have some people at the Capitol that are struggling with this vote. I mean, you can literally see it on the faces. Mm-hmm. I mean, just look at the Senate committee that was made up of all men, I think, except Renee Utterman.
Look
at their faces in that picture. I think that's kind of been going around.
Yeah, we tweeted that photograph
out
yesterday.
It pained them, right? And so I want our listeners to know that this is a political maneuver, not questioning the intent and people and the people's heart. I'm not saying no, but they're trying to get it done during this session while they have the votes. But the second thing is, this is also creating a legal pathway. Let's not forget that our president campaigned on basically overturning Roe v. Wade. And so they know that if Georgia is able to pass a conservative abortion, anti-abortion bill like this with a heartbeat, it strengthens the legal case that you have a state like Georgia to the appellate court to continue the efforts to try to overturn Roe v. Wade. So there's a political avenue here, Kevin and guys, but there's also a legal pathway that I think Republicans need to be exposed on, because it's trying to strengthen the legal argument when this reaches the federal debate.
And again, I think this would not have happened. Again, you can't go back and look. And if it wasn't for the extreme positions in Virginia and in New York, I think it, quite frankly, it scared a lot of people thinking, oh, my gosh, third trimester, that's outrageous. You can't even imagine it. And I think, quite frankly, it made them very concerned. Yeah. And for people that really, I mean, this is such a hard thing because, and the Democrats have been very smart and framed this about trusting women. It's not about trusting women. It's about if you believe that when that heartbeat starts, that is a child. It just makes everything, it makes the conversation very different.
But Jackie, I think you will agree that some women, not all, some, and in 6 weeks, they don't even know if they're pregnant or not. I mean, not all women, but some of the women I've talked to and some women in my family who had to make a choice, many of them decided to have their children. They didn't even know they were pregnant in 6 weeks. So I think I am standing with Democrats where I want to trust that woman and their spouse when they have to make that decision.
It is a hard decision. I'll give you one more. I know we've got to move on, but I'll give you one random, I think, known but not well published. So my grandfather, my father's father, when he went to enlist in the Navy when he was 18, found out that the woman that he thought was his sister was his mother. So I'm just saying, you know, wow. The decisions like this have been around for a long time. They're very hard decisions.
Yeah. We're going to watch how this unfolds. I have said, Kevin, ever since this first passed out of committee, that in the House, that this is one of those bills that you would think leaders would want to get out of there as fast as possible. Why do you let it linger? Why? I'd love to know, and maybe Theron or Jackie are more in touch with what's happening down there. Why is the House delaying on this agree-disagree? The faster you get this out of the way, the fewer people are going to be down there lobbying one way or the other like crazy. I don't understand. Do you have any sense of why they haven't already acted?
Well, I think that, and again, I don't want to get into predicting what the speaker and the lieutenant governor and the governor's floor leaders are attempting to do before Sonny die. I will tell you that just from being down there a lot, Bill, is that they're trying to sort of get as many bills as they can pass, and they saw the amount of emotion, the amount of controversy that this caused. And so, okay. You know, at a time where we just talked about the governor passing his Medicaid waivers bill, it's all about sort of strategically pushing them through to basically get.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. There is a certain amount of sense in that. Thank you for helping us understand that. Why don't we do this? We got so much more to talk about. Why don't we get, though, our second break of the show out of the way so we can come back and move on, march through this agenda that we have to take up today. You're listening to Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, comic, writer, and actor John Mulaney. He used to write for Saturday Night Live and returned twice in the past year to host the show. He also does the voice of Andrew in the animated series Big Mouth about adolescence and puberty. His comedy special Kid Gorgeous at Radio City is streaming on Netflix. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
My name is Chuck Reese. I'm the editor of an online magazine called The Bitter Southerner, and I've seen decades of misconceptions about the South from the Beverly Hillbillies on down. In our podcast with GPB, we challenge those stereotypes and paint a very different picture of the American South. You can subscribe to The Bitter Southerner podcast for free at gpb.org/podcasts.
We're back on Political Rewind. Kevin Riley, editor of the AJC, Jackie Cushman, Theron Johnson in the studio for today's broadcast. Before we move on, I want to remind everybody, Monday night, April 8th, we'll be out in Athens at Instructional Plaza. Jackie, before the show, said, that sounds very serious. It sounded had a sort of a Soviet-era ring to it, you know. Anyhow, we're going to be there at 7 o'clock that night, recording Political Rewind in front of a live audience. It'll air the next day at 2 o'clock, as our show usually does. We're going to have a couple of UGA alums, Greg Bluestein, will be on the show. So will Jim Galloway, Charles Bullock, who is kind of one of the legendary professors of political science out there. They'll all be joining us. So if you want to be part of our show that night, just go to politicalrewind.org, and you'll find a link where you can sign up. It's free, But we need, in fact, now we're starting to get really crowded. So I would suggest if you really want to come see us, and we hope you do, it's a lot of fun when we do the show in front of a live audience. Just go to that link and sign up as quickly as you can. All right, enough of that. On Sunday, Theron, you and I both were we both saw Kamala Harris in different settings on Sunday. Sunday is the first, you know, after spending 20 years covering presidential candidates all over the country, I finally have sort of stopped doing it. I haven't been out on the road, certainly, and I haven't even been going to see the couple who have already come in here. And I decided on Sunday it was a good day to finally get a chance to see some of these folks in person. So I went to Ebenezer Baptist Church, where she had been welcomed by Raphael Warnock. And it was the 11 o'clock service. It was packed for her. And then you saw her in a different setting. You were a fundraiser for her. Good crowd at the fundraiser?
Yeah, no recordings. So they made that very, very clear.
I get that. I'm not asking you to reveal anything.
No. But no, I think, Bill, to your point, what I saw in Senator Kamala Harris is what I saw in President Barack Obama back in 2007 when he first came to Atlanta. You may remember it was this sort of just aura. It was just this momentum. And one of the things that she talked about at Ebenezer, and she also talked about at the private fundraiser, is don't miss this moment. And I was telling Jackie before we started before we went live, is that I saw certain spurts of Obama in her. I mean, this affectious smile that she has, but more importantly, she's able to really drill down about certain things like the economy and healthcare and education. And more importantly, she talked about the things that unite us as Americans more so than divide us. And the other thing that was very interesting, Bill, is when she was talking to us both on Sunday, that's when the Mueller report was basically about to come out. So I'm assuming that she was sort of not knowing what was going to come out. But let me tell you this. I think that she had five events. And so every spectrum of the city, whether it was low dollar fundraisers, people who didn't get a chance to do the fundraisers, everyone got a chance to actually hear from her. And I think that she's going to run a good campaign.
So Robert Jimison, our producer, was also at Ebenezer Baptist on Sunday. And he realized what a lot of us who've been there over the years do. That's a remarkable place if you're a candidate for anything. Well, you don't have to be a candidate to love going to Ebenezer on a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. But Robert was really intrigued by the candidate visit and filed this report.
Colorful hats, welcoming ushers, traditional spirituals, and even a politician or two. These are regular rituals for churchgoers who attend historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta's Sweet Auburn neighborhood. The church home of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made its mark during the Civil Rights Movement as a place where leaders were born, the epicenter for the black community to worship, gather, and work together to promote social justice. Today, Ebenezer maintains that legacy as a congregation actively engaged in its community by continuing its mission to promote social justice. That often means serving as the bridge between political leaders and the community. To some, featuring a political candidate in the pulpit on a Sunday morning might seem unusual. But as Emory political science professor Dr. Andrew Gillespie explains it, churches in the black community encompass more than religious teachings.
The African American church has long been an important place for social organizing. So it's not just a place for spiritual development, but it's also been a community center. It's a place where people socialized. It's a place where people organized for political activity. And Ebenezer and other churches played a really central role in the civil rights movement as we understand it in the mid-20th century. Ebenezer has continued that tradition.
For Ebenezer, the tradition did not end during the 1950s and 1960s. The effort to promote civil rights continues in their mission today. And that ethos is what has allowed the space to be used by Jesse Jackson, who preached ahead of his 1988 run for president. And in 2014, when former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder spoke to the congregation about policing after a black man was shot by a white officer in Ferguson, Missouri.
The issues raised in Missouri are not unique to that state or to that small city.
Earlier this month, former Vice President Al Gore held a forum on climate change. And during campaign season, the church welcomes the likes of Senator David Perdue, Cory Booker, and most recently Kamala Harris. Church leaders like Senior Pastor Ralph Warnock are clear. The church and the congregation does not officially endorse any candidate. They have stated in the past that they abide by federal regulations banning churches and other charitable organizations from endorsing candidates. And candidates, too, must be careful with their word choice when standing in front of the historic congregation.
I told Pastor, I said, I learned a long time ago, I let preachers preach and I just come up to share a few words.
As the 2020 campaign season ramps up, Ebenezer Baptist Church is sure to play host to many more local and national political candidates.
That's Robert Jimison reporting. Jackie, did your dad campaign? Or you can't really campaign. You've got to be careful.
He hasn't. I mean, you don't campaign there, obviously, right? You don't. You just go speak there. He actually has spoken.
But did you do a lot of churches?
Oh, my gosh. He did a lot of churches. when I was growing up, usually churches with four people in the, right? And they were listening to him. But he's actually been at Ebenezer. He went there years ago when what's now our house, which used to be Genesis Shelter, had their anniversary, and he helped us kick that off and raise some money for the nonprofit that works on homeless children and their families. But I've got to say, Reverend Warnock, he and I served together on the Gears Board. I think a lot of them, that church obviously has a lot of historic significance as well as current day influence, and she's smart to go there.
Yeah. Look, to hear Raphael Warnock preach is just a great thing. I've got to say, Theron, one of my greatest experiences in covering presidential I used to travel with Jesse quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing Jesse Jackson, I remember a night when he was at a church, an African-American church in Cleveland, Ohio, and he was particularly on that night. We'd all sat in his hotel suite earlier that evening, the reporters who were with him, and he said, watch, I'm going to do it tonight. He blew the roof off the place. Watching an African-American candidate in an African-American church can be really explosive.
And I agree totally with Dr. Gillespie. I mean, Ebenezer in particular mm-hmm. has been a place where, yes, you go there to worship, but you also go there for social socializing and different things. But one of the things that Jackie just pointed out is, listen, Ebenezer for a long time has been one of the safest places a Republican elected official can go.
Explain that.
Because, you know, you look at Senator Perdue is there. You look at Attorney General Chris Carr, who start mm-hmm. talking about how we need to expand our scope on Stone Mountain, and we need to. He basically yep. came out and did Bell Tower. And so, well, yes, it's a very necessary place that Democrats go, but it's been mm-hmm. the place that Republicans probably feel the most at home.
Johnny Isaacson always attends the MLK service and sits through the entire thing.
And the thing about the African-American community, we are probably some of the most forgiving people when, you know, people do things. I mean, there are some folks that have stood in the pulpit of Ebenezer that clearly has done things that directly affects us in a negative way, but we allow them to speak, and it's not some of the things that you would see in sort of a public rally. And so I think that Reverend Warnock, has injected politics in a very safe way that doesn't violate his 501c3 status, but he's opened it up to a younger, more vibrant congregation. And then you still have some of the people like Congressman John Lewis. My godmother, Vicki Johnson, is still a member there. She's been there for decades. And so I think that you're going to see more Democrats start to come to that church, but I guarantee you, you're going to see a few more Republicans go there as well.
Kevin?
You know, the Reverend Warnock's a regular contributor to our opinion pages and a very reliable one, although we usually have to ask him to cut it back a little bit.
His congregants every now and then say that too.
Yeah, he usually gives us something that's a little too long, but we depend on him for a perspective. You know, I do think while there's always a temptation to put people in boxes in terms of the point of views they'll represent and what they want to comment on, I think he's a reliable, thoughtful person, not just in this community, but really mm-hmm. For the country.
All right. Well, I really appreciate Robert filing that. You know, as the presidential campaign picks up and as Georgia, do you agree that Georgia is going to really be in play in 2020 in presidential politics?
Well, one of the other reasons I went to D.C. is that I met with about five of my former Obama alumni colleagues. And it's very interesting that out of the five of them, three of them are currently strongly considering getting back into the presidential politics game. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they all remember me doing, Bill, is begging Jim Messina, who was the president's campaign manager, President Obama's campaign manager at the time, to say, hey, Georgia's in play, Georgia's in play. But we made a financial decision to protect Florida and Virginia, mm-hmm. and we made a play. So I guarantee you this, I'll make this, Georgia is going to see not only a lot of visits, but we're going to see a lot of money. We are a battleground state. We are truly a purple state, and presidential candidates are going to play heavy here.
Jackie?
And I think it's actually good for Georgia because, I mean, I think both of us have felt the in years past where money was sucked out and spent other places. And so I think it's actually good for both parties that we're, I mean, I think they're both going to campaign very heavily in Georgia, and Georgians should take it seriously.
Goodness knows it's good for the TV stations.
Absolutely.
Campaign advertising revenue.
Don't forget, I moved here from Ohio. Uh-huh. So to me, it was sort of odd at first that campaign season would come and be the way it was, and there were anything. There were non-political commercials on television, right? But I do agree with Jackie. I think that Georgia needs to recognize how important it will become. And it won't just be, you know, the campaigns and the campaign spending, all of which is nice, especially for us who work in the media. But more important, there are things that will come to the state and things that the state and its leaders can demand because it's so important and because people who want to win the White House have got to be successful in Georgia.
All right, we're running a little bit short on time, but Theron, one of the questions I asked in church on Sunday, getting there early, asked a number of members of the church was, what do you all think about this proposal that Stacey Abrams should run on a ticket with Joe Biden? Is this really a thing out there, Theron?
Well, what was the response you got?
Some people thought that she should have her own, be independent and run her own campaign right. at whatever level she chooses to do it. But you know, Biden's pretty popular in that crowd. I mean, people like Joe Biden. The African-American community is high on him. So it was mixed. But where is she at? I mean, have you talked to her?
I have not talked to her directly, but I have talked to some folks that are still helping her. And, you know, she's got this fair fight still going on. I've also talked to some people in the Biden campaign. The reoccurring theme I've heard from both of them is they're weighing all the options. And so I think this sort of VP thing with her and Joe Biden was sort of constructed, I think, a lot by the media. You hadn't really heard Biden's people come out and say, hey, this is something we're doing. I think, as we call him Uncle Joe, he's really looking at this as going. But look, but I got to commend Stacey Abrams. I mean, she has stayed popular. Yeah. She stayed in the media since her unfortunate defeat in November. And so I think that she is hearing a lot from what I've been hearing from African-American women, especially. Don't settle for VP. If you're going to run for in the national ticket.
And that's what a number of the people at Ebenezer. Yeah. You know what's I said this yesterday. Stacey Abrams now, she recognizes she has become a national figure. She was very quick to put out a statement about the Mueller report. Mm-hmm. It was a funny statement. Well, she didn't put out a statement. I'm sorry. She said this to a group that had come to see her when she was on her book tour. She said, having William Barr come out with a report on the Mueller report was like your brother interpreting your report card. But the point is, that's where she sees herself now, as a figure whose comments and thoughts are deserving of national attention. That's fascinating.
Well, no, and they are. I mean, she's very smart. I've always said, I mean, Stacey Abrams is very smart. She's a very hard worker. I think it's up to her to decide what she wants to do next.
All right. You realize that we were just about out of time. Thank you, Jackie.
True professional.
Theron Johnson, Jackie Cushman, Kevin Riley. We're back again tomorrow at 2. We're going to talk legislature, of course, because Greg Bluestein will be here. But there's a very important case being argued in the Supreme Court today about gerrymandering. We'll talk about what its implications could be for the state of Georgia. So come on back tomorrow at 2. We'll be here. Hope you will, too.